Hello, my name is Philip Miratin, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion.
Breaking new ground in thinking, exploring the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, unhindered by common beliefs and perceptions. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, taking on subjects from the Big Bang, the multiverse, and evolution to the supernatural and the new rising consciousness. This is where scientists, philosophers, New Agers, and spiritualists come together to discuss where this world may be heading. Now, here's your host, lawyer, philosopher, and the author of The Heaven at the End of Science, Philip Miratin.
Now, in 1993, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Leon Lederman published a book that he entitled The God Particle. This book, with a dramatic title, is about the search for the Higgs boson, the missing piece of the puzzle known as the standard model of particle physics. This past July 4th, we learned that scientists at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, the world's largest and most powerful particle accelerator, had found evidence consistent with the elusive Higgs boson, leading to the question of whether, now that evidence of the Higgs boson has been discovered, what is left for particle physics? Time to pack up the bags and find another job? Has science unlocked the secret to the universe, as some commentators have said? They found the Holy Grail, the missing link and the last piece of the puzzle? Is this the discovery of the century, ensuring Nobel Prizes for everybody involved? Or is it just a expected outcome of a theory that's been around for a few decades? What exactly did the scientists find? What does it mean? And what does it mean for us? Some might say that modern physics has gone far beyond the comprehension of the human mind, of the normal person on the street. So on today's show, what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to cut through some of the media buzz and hyperbole and ask the questions, what is the Higgs particle and what does it mean? And I'm lucky to have on the show today Professor John Gunyon, Distinguished Professor of Physics at the University of California at Davis. He's also the co-author of the book, The Higgs Hunter Guide. Welcome to the show, Professor Gunyon.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the interview.
Okay, so now, like everything else, but more so in the case of the Higgs boson, I think to try to understand this topic, it's going to help to draw the big picture. And so let's start here. In the newspaper accounts and in the media, CNN, the BBC, and so on, we've heard about the standard model of particle physics, and it's almost becoming a part of the modern lexicon. But I have a funny feeling most people would not know what the standard model is. And so let's first try to describe what the standard model of particle physics is. So why don't you try to give that a shot?
Well, I hope that most people are familiar with the electron. It's the particle that underlies all of electronics and electricity and so forth. That's one of the particles in the standard model. Another particle that I hope the readers and listeners have heard of is the photon. The photon is the quantum of light. So when you see a light bulb, you're actually seeing millions of photons coming into your eye, exciting your cortex. So that's another particle of the standard model. Now, there's a difference. The electron is what we call a matter particle, and the photon is actually a carrier of force. So two electrons can interact by exchanging a photon. So in the standard model, we actually have a bunch of matter particles. There's the electron, the muon, the tau lepton. Those are what we call leptons. Then there are quarks. There's an up quark, a down quark, a strange quark, a charm quark, a top quark, and a bottom quark. So there's six kinds of quarks. And then there are actually four force mediators, one of them being the photon, another being the W boson, a third being the Z boson, and the fourth being actually gravity. So there's, as you know, gravity draws planets together. In fact, an important idea regarding gravity is the fact that it acts on what is called mass. So every particle, like the electron, the bottom quark, the charm quark, top quark, they all are attracted by the gravitational force, and the degree of that attraction is determined by the mass of the elementary particle in question. So you have mass because the when you stand on a scale, the gravitational field of the Earth attracts you downwards on the scale, and that gravitation is attracting your mass. So your mass turns into weight as measured on the scale. Yeah. One other important carrier of force is what's called the gluon, which is responsible for what is known as the strongest force of nature. So that's the those are the basic particles, matter particles, and force carriers of the Standard Model. And what has been missing in this picture is a full understanding of what it is that's responsible for mass. And that's what the Higgs issue is all about. The Higgs boson has everything to do with how it is that particles, and therefore planets and people and the Earth and the Sun, acquire mass and were able to clump together in the very early universe and form constellations and galaxies and suns and right. planets and so forth and so on.
Okay, so let me just try to sort of summarize and paraphrase a little bit what you said in my simple terms, and that is, a couple thousand years ago, there was a Greek philosopher. His name was Democritus. And Democritus is credited with coming up with the idea that at the base of reality is a cutless piece of something, a hard atom. And since that time, and really in the last couple hundred years, modern physics has in many ways refined this basic principle to what we now have as the Standard Model. And by that I mean it's the theory that at the base of reality is a fundamental collection of particles. And as the professor just indicated, the menu of fundamental particles, I think there's over 20, I believe, if you include the force carrying particles. And so it really is a refinement. And if I have this correctly, professor. These particles that have been discovered, it's really a function of experiments, right? I mean, this is the derivation of the Standard Model is based upon experiment. Is that right, or would you say that it's partly theory?
No, it's absolutely entirely experiment.
Right, right.
Of course, there were hypotheses about the existence of these particles. For example, starting with the electron,
right.
But it took experiment to actually verify
right.
that these particles actually exist.
Right.
So now, of course, you know, people everywhere can do the same experiment and see the same phenomena, so there's absolutely no doubt that the electron is really there. It's similarly, all the other particles have been verified in numerous independent experiments.
Yeah, and I think one of the more exciting parts of the Standard Model, and something that a lot of people probably haven't really tuned into, is this notion of force-carrying particles, because that's going to be important when we get to the Higgs, right? Because
absolutely.
Because you could obviously do a better job than I could do explaining it, but in my understanding, that the force-carrying particles, it really is a matter of trying to explain how forces or energy is conveyed across distances. And I believe the quantum theory is involved in determining the nature of the force-carrying particles. Is that right?
Well, right. The visualization is, as I referred to, let's take two electrons
right.
that are passing close to one another. They experience a force, and that force in the quantum theory is due to the exchange of a photon between those two electrons. So one electron, let's say, emits the photon, and then the other electron absorbs the photon, and as a result, the electrons are deviated a little bit from their path. So the photon is the force-carrying particle that causes this interaction between the two electrons.
Yeah, and now another important point to make here is that in addition to the fact that we have force-carrying particles and matter particles, there is another way to approach the question, which is, are the force-carrying particles real? Because are these the same things as virtual particles?
Well, in the situation that I just described to you, where two electrons scatter from one another by virtue of exchange of a photon, that photon is what we would call a virtual particle, because we never see it. It's just an exchange between the two electrons. Right. On the other hand, of course, we can certainly make photons in great abundance and check that the properties of the photons that we see directly are, you know, completely consistent with the, in the quantum structure, with the idea that photons also can be virtual and responsible for the force between two electrons.
Right. Now we're on something, and this is where you got to hold, and there's going to be a couple parts of this conversation where the listeners have to hold on to their seat. But right now, there is an important point that I think is related to the Higgs boson that we're going to have to make, which is that, as far as I understand this in general terms, under the quantum theory, the lighter the particle, or the less mass it has, the farther it can go, the greater the distance it could carry, or the farther it could carry the force. And the heavier it is, the shorter the distance. Because the quantum theory has that uncertainty between mass and energy, and there's some relation there. So the photon does not have mass. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's a massless particle. The gravity is mediated by gravitons, which are the particles associated with the gravitational attraction, the virtual particles, and so. It's these two particles, the photon and the graviton, are massless, and that doesn't, as you were saying, mean that they can have interactions that go out very long ways. They basically, the strength of the interaction just drops off according to the amount of volume that you're trying to cover with the force, whereas the W and Z bosons, which mediate the electroweak force, are massive, and so they can only mediate force over very short distances.
Right. And so I think this is one reason why the standard model, it sort of stretches your understanding a little bit, in the sense that you sort of have to take a different perspective on forces and sort of weave in an understanding of quantum theory where you have massless particles, you have uncertainty, which is related to the mass of the particles, and you have these different particles carrying different forces between different particles. But I think in the big picture, as the professor explained, under the standard model, physicists has almost put the picture together with regard to explaining what particles we believe exist out there, and what virtual particles or what force-carrying particles are associated with what particles. So as you say, you have the Z and the Y force-carrying particle with the weak force. We have the gluon with the strong force. We have the photon with the electromagnetic force, and the graviton, which I understand is hypothetical still.
That's right. There are very big experiments out there hoping to see gravitons as pulses coming from distant Big Bangs and things like that, but they haven't yet actually succeeded in that, but we have every expectation that eventually we will.
Right. Okay, so now we took that little detour to try to give a little bit more color, depth to the standard model, but you already indicated that one of the mysteries of the standard model is why the different particles have the masses they do, right? That's been a ongoing issue with the standard model, right?
Right. That's the standard model has built into it, as formulated, a certain idea as to how particles acquire mass, and of course we've been working to test that idea, And the Higgs boson is a manifestation that very probably the Standard Model picture of how particles acquire mass is correct.
Yeah, now this is sort of a common sense question, and that because I've read about this. I've read about you know the hierarchy problem, for example. Why are the masses of the particles, and I guess the strength of the forces, so different? I guess it goes from, I'm not sure what the weakest, I guess gravity is the weakest, and then what, the strong forces?
Well, let me give you an analogy, okay, if I may.
Sure.
There's something called the Higgs field that we'll be coming to that permeates throughout all of space.
Okay.
Now, the analogy I want you to think about is that instead, the whole universe is filled with, let's say, water. Okay?
Okay.
That's the analog of the Higgs field. Now we're going to place an Olympic swimmer with a sleek bodysuit into the water, and he's going to move through the water, and he's not going to feel that much resistance. Okay, so in this analogy, the resistance would be analogous to mass. So that Olympic swimmer would have a low mass because he doesn't interact very strongly with the water. And let us compare that to some fat guy with a bunch of clothes on and maybe wearing boots, I don't know. This guy is going to have a lot more troubles.
Or we can go with the hippopotamus, too. There's a good example of something that's going to, you know, gather more mass. But
yeah,
anyway.
Right. So this guy or the hippopotamus is going to have a lot of trouble moving through the water, and the analogy would be that the very big resistance that he feels means that he has a much heavier mass. And also, you know, let's imagine the following additional thing that's related to mass. Suppose somebody hits the Olympic swimmer, because he has a light mass, you know, he would be deviated somewhat from his path. Okay. Whereas if somebody hits the heavy guy with his boots and clothes on, he wouldn't deviate very much from his path. So that is another aspect of mass. Mass tells you how hard it is to change motion of some person.
Okay, well, but this is where my question's coming from, though, and that is, we start off with experimental data giving the masses of the particles in the Standard Model, and those masses are different. Okay,
right.
And so my first question is, why is that a problem?
Okay, well, let me. It's not a problem. It's okay. Just something that we don't understand. So even if we understand that there is a Higgs field, there is this water, we don't understand still, and we don't have any good theory yet of why it is that there are different kinds of swimmers in the pool, that is, different particles with different masses coming from the Higgs field. So that's what's called the flavor problem, and we really have no good explanation, no good theory as to why the electron should have, you know, such a very small mass as compared to, let's say, the top quark, which has a much heavier mass. So this is a missing piece, and it's not part of the Standard Model to explain this difference in masses. We hope someday to get some hints about why particles have different masses, but we don't know yet.
Okay, because now I think I'm understanding this a little better, because my first question was, okay, so there's particles with different masses, and so the answer to that is, so my question is, well, so what? There's flowers with different colors, animals with different weights, stars with different luminosities. It's just they're different. And what you're saying is that if I understood you correctly, in the Standard Model, assumed that there would be this field that would give the particles the masses they have.
Right.
Is that right? Okay.
That's correct.
So the Standard Model, and there's a lot of books on this topic, folks, and it's actually pretty interesting. And maybe at some point, Professor, you could give a couple books you'd recommend. But for example, Lisa Randall has written some pretty understandable books on this topic, and I think Sean Carroll, and there's a couple out there that are actually understandable. I think Gordon Cain has a couple or one or two that are understandable, but every time you see a chart that says the standard model, there's always this Higgs down there. I mean, the Higgs has been there for 10, 20 years. I mean, it's been part of the standard model, and I had always thought that the physicists were saying that the Higgs field explains the mass. You're saying that's correct, but it doesn't explain why the masses are the ones that the particles have, right?
Right. Yeah, okay. We understand how the particles can acquire mass by interacting with this Higgs field, and the mass that they acquire is governed by the strength of their interaction with the Higgs field, just as in the example of the swimmers. But we do not have any explanation of why there should be different strengths of interactions with the Higgs field for all the different particles in the standard model. Okay. So those masses are just, if you wish, parameters that we measure experimentally. We know what the masses are. We know they're different. Therefore, we know that these different particles interact differently with the Higgs field, more or less strongly.
Right.
We have no theory of why the strengths are different and why they should be the particular values that they are.
Well, this is one thing that puzzles me, and that is, let's assume there's a Higgs field, and the Higgs field is, as you say, like a swimming pool. And I think there's been other examples out there, you know, tar or something or whatever.
Acids is another one.
Right. I heard somebody, somebody used the example of an ice cream vendor going down a beach with a bunch of kids on it, on the beach, and all the kids swarm towards the ice cream vendor. But I think that was actually in Scientific American, by the way. So. But anyways, okay, so you have this Higgs field that I believe it's called a scalar field, which
That's right.
is where
that
the field
it has no
different
spin.
Okay, it has different, so it has different energy levels at different parts of the field or something. Is that accurate?
No, I don't know that there's anything along those lines that help describe the Higgs field. The Higgs field is basically a constant throughout all of universe.
Okay.
And so what that means, of course, is that if you measure an electron of a certain mass here on Earth and you went out, a few billion light years away, the electron would have exactly the same mass.
Okay, now we're getting to my question. Okay, so the Higgs field's out there, or it's all around, and it's and we're at the early days of the Big Bang, or the early microseconds, whatever. And so you have these, I'm going to say, you have these identical massless particles. They're all the same, and they travel through the Higgs field, and they pick up different masses. Okay, that's one scenario. But that can't be right, because that wouldn't explain why the masses are different. So right. There's still.
Well, let me try to.
Okay, go ahead.
Say something here. Okay. First of all, in the early universe, this Higgs field, which is some constant value, actually in the very early universe had zero value.
Okay.
And then there was a certain transformation related to what we call symmetry breaking. So the early universe was very symmetric, and then there's a symmetry breaking in which the Higgs field suddenly has a non-zero value, what we call a vacuum expectation value. It's at that point when the Higgs field acquires this non-zero value throughout all of space. I mean, there's a very sharp transition,
okay,
but it's quite sudden, and after a few seconds, the Higgs field has this one constant value throughout all of space.
Okay.
And then all these elementary particles at that point will acquire mass, and that mass will be determined by the strength of their interaction with this non-zero value of the Higgs field. But once again, we don't understand why different particles should have different strengths. We just measure the masses and see that they do.
Okay, because what we're really saying here is that there was something different about these particles that caused them to couple at different strength levels with the Higgs field.
Exactly.
Right. So what we're doing, instead of asking the question, well, why do particles have the masses they do, we're now asking the question, why did these early particles have the coupling strength that they
did? Right. Yeah. That's an equivalent question.
Okay. And so now I see. Okay. So, and I hope, and it's this is actually pretty interesting because it's really similar to a lot of where cosmology and physics is going with the use of fields to explain phenomena. I mean, another example would be the inflaton field, and I don't want to go there right now. We had an interview with Paul Steinhardt a couple weeks ago where we talked about the inflaton field, but for those who are really into fields, there's a field that is hypothesized to drive inflation that led to the Big Bang, and there's electromagnetic field and all sorts of other fields, which I'm sure the professor knows a lot more than I do. But the Higgs field is a special case, as I think we just discussed, that we believe is responsible for giving mass to the particles in a standard model, right?
That's okay. Absolutely okay. Correct.
Okay,
and
so
just one other point here is that every field, according to quantum mechanics, has associated with it a fluctuation, what we call a quantum fluctuation or a quantum excitation. And that quantum excitation of the field is the particle associated with the force associated with that field. So there's an electromagnetic field, and the quantum fluctuation of that electromagnetic field is the photon. And just as we have a Higgs field now giving mass to all the particles, that Higgs field has its own quantum fluctuation according to quantum mechanics, and that quantum fluctuation is the Higgs boson.
Okay, so here I said before, that's good, I said before that a couple of times we're going to have to hold on to our seat, and here's another one. And I'm going to do this as straightforward as I can, but I understand that the standard model requires particles to be massless. Right? Is that right?
No, that's not true.
Okay.
The standard model is constructed in such a way that some, if we're talking about force carriers now, that some of the force carriers, like the photon and the gluon, are massless, but
right.
The other force carriers, as a result of this Higgs field and the W and Z bosons interact strongly with the Higgs field, those force carriers will be quite massive. So the standard model has certain symmetries built into it that say that some force carriers are massless and other force carriers are massive.
Why does the standard model need the Higgs mechanism? Is it because as we just said, it really reframes the question of where the mass came from. So what's the need for the Higgs mechanism?
Well, it's first of all, it's just a very elegant mechanism by which these various particles could acquire mass.
Right.
It's also related. Well, let's see. How can I phrase this? The standard model, with all its force carriers, you would want to be able to compute with it to arbitrary precision, even after taking into account all these quantum fluctuations that we're talking about and virtual fluctuations and so forth.
Okay.
Now, this is a property, this computability is a property that is associated with what we call renormalizability. So you want to have a theory where you can compute a theory that is renormalizable, and that requires that the theory have an underlying structure whereby if the Higgs field did not acquire this non-zero value throughout all of space, then every particle would have been massless. So at the very beginning of the universe, when the Higgs field had no vacuum expectation value, no non-zero value, as we call it, throughout all of space, all particles would have been massless. And then all of a sudden, because of symmetry breaking, and it's called spontaneous symmetry breaking, the Higgs field acquires a non-zero value throughout all of space. And at that point, all the particles become massive, except certain ones of them, like the photon and the gluon.
Okay, so another way to put that is to say that the Higgs mechanism aids the mathematical consistency of the standard model?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's crucial to being able to have a mathematically consistent model that you can compute with to arbitrary precision.
Okay. Now, let's turn to the experiment in the Large Hadron Collider. And now you've co-authored a book on this topic, so I take it you've been following what's going on up there quite a lot.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah. Okay. And so, and I take it you know a lot of people out there, and have you been there yourself?
Oh, of course. Yeah. At least maybe 30 times, 40 times, something like that.
Okay. Okay. So you're one of the thousand. That's great. Okay. So now, what did they actually find?
Okay, well, let's talk about, so we have the Higgs field. Okay. Its quantum excitation is the Higgs boson.
Okay.
And the question is, how hard is it to make and observe the Higgs boson?
Okay.
Well, the answer is it's pretty darn hard. That's why it's taken, some very high energy accelerator and very fancy experiments. So what happens is that actually two gluons, we talked about gluons, come together and through a virtual, what do we call a triangle diagram, it's a certain virtual mechanism where the two gluons produce a Higgs boson. Okay?
Okay.
Now this Higgs boson lives an incredibly short time. It disappears because of the uncertainty principle almost immediately, because it's quite massive, so you can't just make something and just have it hang around. It's going to decay.
Okay.
And by decay, I mean that the Higgs boson turns into other particles that are stable within the detector. So two of the particles that it turns into are the following. The Higgs can turn into two photons, and it can also turn into two W bosons, it can also turn into two Z bosons, and it can turn into two B quarks, or B quark and an anti-B quark, the bottom quark, as we call it, and as we referred to earlier. So there are a bunch of possibilities for how we might look for the Higgs boson. We would look for these pairs of particles in the detector. So the detectors have been designed very much with this purpose in mind of, saying, okay, let's suppose there is a Higgs boson. We want to see those two photons, or we want to see the two Z bosons.
Okay, go ahead. I mean, I want to clarify what we're doing right now, because I sort of skipped over a point, which we talked about fields, we talked about force-carrying particles, and just to be clear, the Higgs boson is the force-carrying particle for the Higgs field, correct?
It's the force-carrying particle associated with the Higgs field.
Okay,
so, in the electromagnetic analogy, there's the electromagnetic field. The photon is the quantum excitation of the electromagnetic field, and it mediates the electromagnetic force. So in the Higgs case, there's the Higgs field, the Higgs boson is the quantum excitation of the Higgs field, and it can certainly mediate force associated with the Higgs field.
Okay, so those who are following this, the reason what this experiment's doing is it's looking for the force-carrying particle associated with the hypothetical Higgs field that is assumed to be part of the Standard Model.
Correct.
And so, continue with your description of what the experiment did.
Okay, so let's focus on the two-photon final state. So the Higgs in the very middle of the detector is produced, and it decays instantaneously to these two photons. You know, one heads then in one direction, and the other heads in the opposite direction. There has to be a balance of momentum. You can't have, you know, both photons go out in the same direction, because then, it would violate fundamental momentum conservation laws of physics.
Right.
Okay, so one photon goes in one direction, the other photon goes in the other direction, and then you have to detect these photons. So the detectors have these very fancy things called electromagnetic calorimeters that are looking at these photons, determining the energy and momentum of the photons, and then they can, by relativity, you can put the energy and momentum of the two photons together and determine the mass of the particle from which they came. So what happens then is that you have many collisions, you make many Higgs bosons, you reconstruct the mass of the two photon system for these many collisions, and you discover that there's an accumulation of events where the two photons reconstruct to exactly the same mass, namely this 125 GeV.
Okay, and that mass is within the range of the theoretical mass of the Higgs boson in the original theory?
Well, we'll have to come back perhaps to the mass of the Higgs boson. That's an important topic. The mass was not predicted, of the Higgs boson was not predicted in the context of the Standard Model. It was a parameter. Once you know the mass of the Higgs boson, then you know exactly how often, say, two photons are seen in your detector versus two Z bosons are seen in your detector. And that's because, all of the, everything that the Higgs does, every channel that it decays into, the relative rates of those channels are determined by the masses of the particles that are coming out. So the Z boson pair rate relative to, let's say, the W boson pair rate, or the, 2B quark pair rate relative to the two photon decay rate, all those relative rates as if were determined once you know the mass of the Higgs boson, but not until you know the mass of the Higgs boson.
Okay, so I'm not sure I completely follow that. Are you saying that the experiments determined the mass of the Higgs boson, or whether the experimental apparatus was set up to find a mass within a certain range?
No, the experiment was designed to find the Higgs boson no matter what mass it had. It's just that the appropriate channels, the best final states to use, are dependent upon the mass of the Higgs boson.
Okay.
So, and the fact that for the particular mass observed at 125 GeV, all of these relative rates were predicted in the context of the Standard Model once we knew what that Higgs boson mass. And the dramatic thing from the experiment is that all these relative rates are, more or less in agreement with the Standard Model prediction. The errors are still substantial, so we can't be sure that they're precisely in agreement with the Standard Model prediction, but it's sufficiently close to the Standard Model prediction that we're very confident that the particular object that we've seen at CERN really is a Higgs boson and not just some random thing that has nothing to do with the Higgs boson.
Okay, and so how would you yourself put the level of confidence that this finding is the Higgs boson as opposed to just another particle or just another force-carrying particle?
Well, I would certainly say that it is a Higgs boson in the sense that it's very directly connected to the generation of mass. Now, there are theories out there that have more than one Higgs boson, so that, Higgs boson number one generates part of the mass of the elementary particles, and Higgs boson number 2 generates the rest of the mass of the elementary particles. But what we're seeing is sufficiently close to the standard model Higgs that the Higgs that we're seeing is, you know, close to being a Higgs that is very much like the standard model Higgs boson, although there might be some other Higgs boson out there that, you know, does 10% or 20% of the mass generation. The one we're seeing probably does about 70 or 80% of the mass generation.
Okay, so here's my question, and once in a while I ask perhaps an unfair question, but how is it that we can go from finding suggestions of the Higgs boson in a particle accelerator to the conclusion that therefore the Higgs field permeates all space?
Well, you have to accept the idea that the generation of mass is associated with the Higgs field. Okay, then you have to accept the experimental observation that electrons measured here on Earth and electrons measured a billion miles light years away have the same mass. Now, if that were not true, then of course we would have, in fact, contradiction with the idea that the Higgs field permeates all of space, and with the idea that wherever the Higgs field is, it has the same basic value.
Okay. So it's really the beauty of this discovery, and I think the impressive part of it is that it fills in this expected or assumed value in the standard model, because the Higgs field has been a part of the standard model for quite a while. Is that true?
Since the very beginning. So the Higgs field and Higgs boson was actually proposed before we had the standard model. And the standard model just incorporated the idea of the Higgs field into this complete theory, you know, involving the quarks and the photon, the gluon, and the leptons, the electron, muon, and tau.
And do you know what led, and I know that Peter Higgs was not the only one to be associated with this particle, although he's lucky enough now to have it associated with his name, and I guess, and I don't know all the details, but I take it that's the way it is sometimes in the academic community.
Yeah, it just happens. In some sense, he wrote the paper that made this clearest. I mean, there were other papers out there by, you know, five other people that were also discussing this, but Peter Higgs was the first person who really made it really clear that there was a Higgs boson to be found.
Okay, and do you know what the logic of his reasoning was? Why did he originally believe that there had to be a Higgs particle?
Well, as you know, one starts with the mass generation, the Higgs field, and then once you have that idea in your head, as I said, in quantum theory, every field has its quantum excitation. And so he put this idea together that there really was a reality to the Higgs field, and therefore quantum mechanics requires that there be a Higgs boson. It's just that simple. You know, he was the first person to really sort of get it totally right.
I see. Now I know you've been interviewed a lot, and I'm sure you've heard the pejorative phrase, the God particle. What's your feeling about calling the Higgs the God particle?
Well, I think almost every physicist that you talk to is kind of uncomfortable with that. It's a phrase that, you know, associated with Leon Letterman. You know, when I first heard it, I felt, oh God, that's not good.
Yeah, it sort of does elevate expectations a little bit, and I think
I think that was the idea. You know, Letterman wanted to get people excited about this particle, and I guess it served its purpose. But you know, it may come back to haunt us, I think.
Yeah, because if there's another particle that's more important, then it's going to be hard to come up with a better name than the God particle.
I mean, you're absolutely right.
I mean, that's a big problem. I mean, how do you overcome this one? And I. You know, one of the things about that book, which I've read, is it's sort of a contradiction in a way, because he writes in a very sort of casual, humorous way, and it's actually pretty easy to read in this area. But he's got this saying in there. He's got this point he makes that the final scientific theory should be simple enough to write on a T-shirt. And I always thought that's really good, but this Higgs boson issue is not something that's going to fit on a T-shirt.
Well, in some sense, it does. Okay. You just add a certain, the standard model is described by a certain mathematical thing called a Lagrangian.
Okay.
And the Lagrangian has, a bunch of terms in it involving quarks and leptons and photons and so forth. And all you have to do is add about, and it contains, let's say, I don't know the actual number, but let's say 30 terms in it. Mathematical expressions in it.
Right.
To describe the Higgs business, you only have to add about six more terms to this Lagrangian. So it still fits on a T-shirt,
okay.
In other words.
Okay, well, maybe that's a new business to be into. It probably would sell pretty well right now because this is getting a lot of press. So
In fact, there are lots of T-shirts out there that have the Higgs boson stuff on it.
I'm late to the game. I'm too late. And someone's probably copyrighted and patented it already, so I'm probably really late. What does this say, if anything, if you're able to answer this, about superstring theory? Does this have any relevance for superstring theory? The finding of the Higgs or the suggestions about the Higgs?
Okay, well, this is a bit of a story, but let me try to give it. The Higgs boson undergoes quantum fluctuations. Let's take the most dramatic one. It can temporarily, by the uncertainty principle, turn into a top and an anti-top quark. After all, it does couple to a top and an anti-top because, that's how the top acquires mass. And then this top-anti-top lasts a very short time and turns back into the Higgs boson. So it's a virtual fluctuation of the Higgs boson. The problem is that when you compute this correction mathematically, you discover it's absolutely enormous and that there's no reason why the Higgs boson should have such a small mass as 125 GeV. So now what do you do? Okay, one idea is you introduce what's called supersymmetry, whereby there's a second fluctuation into partners of the top quark. They're called stops. And this other fluctuation mathematically cancels the first one from the top quarks. That's the structure of supersymmetry.
Okay.
That cancellation occurs automatically so long as these stop quarks aren't too heavy. Okay, so anyway, now we've got supersymmetry according to which every standard model particle has a supersymmetric partner. Okay.
Okay.
What about supersymmetry? That's where superstring theory enters, because superstring theory is almost certain to have a substructure in it that looks like supersymmetry.
Okay. So, in sum, are the string theorists happy or sad about this finding?
I think they're very happy that the Higgs boson has been observed. They would love to see that it's not exactly a standard model Higgs boson, because in supersymmetry, there should be two Higgs bosons, roughly speaking.
Right.
And so the properties of the Higgs boson that we're seeing should hopefully deviate a little bit from the standard model Higgs boson properties. If we see that deviation, then we know there is physics beyond the standard model. There has to be at least another Higgs boson, and that fits in very nicely to supersymmetry.
Well, we've at least I have another question, but before I forget, I want to say that we've at least answered one of the questions I posed in the beginning of the show, which is that we're not going to be seeing physicists packing up their bags and going home. There sure is a lot more investigation and questions to answer. Now, I want to ask a sort of more of a philosophical question, or maybe a philosophy of science question right now, because, the standard model is called a model. And I always wonder whether physicists and cosmologists as well are building models of reality, or whether they're saying that these models depict reality as it really is. And what side of the line do you come down on that?
Well, I would say the models depict reality as experimentally verified and as experimentally explored. The standard model was constructed on the basis of experiments. So right. You repeat the same experiment 1,000 times, you get the same answer, then you know that you want to write down something that explains, describes these results mathematically, and that's what the standard model does. It explains and gives the correct answer for millions upon millions of experiments performed everywhere.
Yeah, and the reason I ask that question is because I think that there is a connection here to the multiverse, unfortunately. And this is the connection I would make, and that is, the more sort of finely tuned some of the parameters are, the more it suggests that there is some kind of assumption of fine tuning you have to make, or it leads into the multiverse people. So that's why I asked that question, and that to me is a very intriguing issue, and we clearly don't have time to get into it here, but when we hit the question of why does the Higgs field couple the way it does, and why did the masses turn out to be the way they are, it tells me that there's still mysteries that we have to solve out there. This is not the God particle. This is not the secret to the universe. And I think that if anything else on this show, I hope that the listeners understood, and maybe you got to listen to the show a couple times, but I hope the listeners understood that the Higgs particle, and we're not quite, even Scientific American today on their website said that physicists found particle resembling the Higgs boson. I don't know if people are quite ready to pound the table, although it seems, Professor, you're basically there. And in some ways, it doesn't make that much difference. But the point is that we're still at a point where there's questions to be asked, mysteries to be solved. What this has done is it has verified an assumed value in the standard model, and if nothing else, that would be cause for celebration, because I think those of you who have used the standard model as the basis for understanding reality, to have a hypothetical quantity verified must be very gratifying.
It's extremely exciting. It's a verification of all of the mathematical structures and ideas that we've been building up over the last 40 or 50 years.
So do you see that the road to the graviton is going to be similar, or the graviton poses a different set of issues, or what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's very hard to know how the graviton situation will play out. As I say, there are these large experiments out there that are looking for gravitational waves, which are made up of gravitons.
Right.
To actually produce a single graviton and observe it is, certainly way beyond any technology that we have now. The best we could do is to detect a gravitational wave that has many gravitons in it, and we haven't even succeeded in that yet, although we have hopes that we will eventually observe a gravitational wave, a gravitational pulse from some distant Big Bang or similar.
Right, and I think that just to close off this point, this is the reason, isn't it, why string theory is out there, because of the irreconcilable match between gravity or the general relativity and quantum theory.
That's correct. Right. You can't really construct a consistent theory without going to a gravity. and quantum mechanics without going to something similar to string theory.
Yeah, so I'd like to thank you very much for your time, Professor. And granted, it's been maybe not an easy listening hour. On the other hand, I think it's important for those who are out there to really understand what this is, trying to take away some of the hyperbole, some of the media buzz. This is a very important discovery. It does find, as Professor indicated, a missing link in the standard model. But it's not the end of science. It's not the secret to the universe, and it really isn't the God particle either. This is Philip Mirtin. Thank you, Professor. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion.
Well, it's been my pleasure to participate.
You've been listening to Conversations Beyond Science and Religion with Philip Mirtin. To find out more about Philip and his new book, The Heaven at the End of Science, visit heavenattheendofscience.com.